Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. It was about 11 o'clock at night in early June 1991 when I flew into Anchorage for the first time, freshly divorced and coming off a rough couple of years. I remember roaming the streets of downtown Anchorage, marveling at the sunlit mountains, thinking how odd it seemed that no one was out even though it was light. The purpose of my trip was a three-month experiential education course for young adults as a student with the National Outdoor Leadership School, which I think is better known as NOLS, based in Palmer, Alaska. Those 80-plus days spent traveling in some of Alaska's wildest lands changed the course and quality of my life forever. The wilderness got into my blood and never left. Whether it was the two-week backpacking trip in the Talkeetna Mountains with my 14-year-old foster child, or the 32-day backcountry trek with my brother and Yellow Lab Levi, being in the wild for extended periods of time always alters my perspective and resets my clock. It simplifies things. My worries limited to safety, hydration, hunger, and rest. It was that experience, that time traveling in the wilderness with 17 other souls, that convinced me of the power of the wilderness has to help facilitate change. I went on that trip a mess, physically and emotionally, and came off that trip as fit and focused and driven as I've ever been. Today's show is focused on experiential education, in particular, wilderness-based treatment as an option for teens with emotional and behavioral problems. Over the last 9 years as an individual and family therapist, I have referred a number of the young people I work with to the Alaska Crossings Program in Wrangell, Alaska. The majority of these referrals were due to severe behavioral problems and emotional difficulties at home and in the community. Without fail, these young men and women have returned from the experience with improved confidence and with a new sense of hope about the possibilities for their future. Most have reported that it was one of the toughest and most rewarding experience of their lives. Joining me today from Wrangell to discuss wilderness-based treatment services are Program Director Steve Helgeson, directing clinician Casey Odell, intake coordinator Katie Fitzgerald, and a late addition is Kelly Jo Pruitt, who is an Alaska Crossings field guide and works with some of our local kids as a caseworker for homeless youth at the Covenant House during the winter. So thank you all for taking the time to join me.
Thank you, Prentice.
Thank you.
Okay, remember, Line 1 is a live call-in show, so your calls and emails are encouraged and appreciated. We can be reached with your questions or comments in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way, as always, is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please don't hesitate to call in today, especially if you or a family member have an experience about today's topic that you'd like to share. All right, let's, start off with, we have some folks in Wrangell and one in studio, and we want to make sure that we keep everybody identified. There's a lot of moving parts, so we'll do our best here. Let's start off with the folks in Wrangell, and Steve, give us a little bit, start with you about your background, and we'll just go around and how you got to be at Alaska Crossings.
So my background is administrative, and I started with Alaska Crossings in 2002 as the support services director. From there, I moved on to an assistant director position, helping with program management and facilities and logistics management. Then I took a short divergence, I should say, from the program, although I was still related to it, working for the parent agency in an administrative capacity, but I still retained the responsibilities of fiscal management and physical asset management for the program. And then in 2011, in October of 2011, I took over as the director of the program.
Okay. Thanks. How about you, Casey?
I came to work for Alaska Crossing sort of by happenstance. I've been working in the field with adolescents for roughly 7 years now. I was actually living in Anchorage working as a clinician at AK Child and Family on one of their youth female girl units. And I just kind of fell into Googling wilderness therapy, and I discovered Alaska Crossings, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, great. And Katie, you're there as well?
Yep, I'm here.
I began working for Alaska Crossings in 2008. I was working seasonally as an intake assistant, and then it was just such an amazing program that I couldn't help but come back, and I've been working as an intake coordinator since then.
All right, thanks. And Kelly Joe in studio, last but not least, our late addition who decided to walk in. That's nice to have you.
Thanks. It's good to be here. I've worked with youth at risk all over the world for a number of years now, and recently moved back to Alaska and was working at the Covenant House as a caseworker, and met several of my clients there, have been through crossings and just raved about it, that it was the time of their lives and challenging, but definitely one of the best parts of their lives. And they would just rave about the skills they learned. And so that encouraged me to check it out. And this was my first season, and I'm very excited to partner with Crossings.
And as a field guide, you were the one who was actually out on the expeditions with the kids.
Correct.
Day in and day out. Okay, we have, before we get into the meat of our conversation, we have a phone call right off the bat. I got Kevin, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin D. I'm the executive director of Gaia Wilderness Education down in Homer. And I just want to, first of all, acknowledge the crossing. We've referred people and teens to them, and we provide programs that are adventure-based as well. And the components of a wilderness trip for teens or young adults or even adults can be transformative. I know that they're doing great work down there, and I want to acknowledge that. And I want to also ask them about follow-up. We do similar programs in Homer since 1984, and we always require two components. One is a service component, and to give back to the state parks, the national park, wherever we're operating. And secondly, we also provide coaching services to the students to complete our programs. Is Crossings evolving to that model as well?
Are you referring to coaching after they complete the program?
Correct. You know, life coaching, how you doing? You've had this transformative experience. And then to go back to the environment for some of the kids who have the problems, if it's a therapeutic approach, do you provide any coaching services as follow-up?
Sounds like you're talking about aftercare program.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Well, with our aftercare programs, we're exploring a lot of different areas to try to facilitate more wraparound services for our youth when we're sending them back to their home environment. One of the things we worked on this year was working with the parents and the treatment teams back at home to identify a mentor, and then drawing connections with that mentor to try to set our youth up to have somebody back in their home environment, aside from a parent who is going to set time aside to spend with that youth, just pursuing interests that they have and helping them to continue to develop their life skills. So we serve youth from all over Alaska, and we've had some success with that approach, but it's also very dependent on the community that our youth are coming from. We do have a large proportion of our youth are from small villages that just simply don't have a lot of services and infrastructure. So then we focus a lot of our energies on really supporting the families and building that up as much as possible. And we are also, over the course of the past 2 years largely, we've been sending teams to, you know, our HUD communities like Barrow and Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, to try to facilitate stronger working relationships with the providers in those areas so that we can continue to facilitate a very strong discharge plan for all of our youth. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. It really, I think, is a critical component. A wonderful event back when I worked with Outward Bound or seen Knowles programs, National Outdoor Leadership School or Outward Bound, in a therapeutic setting, unless there is follow-through, there tends to be a lot of recidivism.
Yes, Kevin, and I'm really glad you brought up that point, and that's one of the topics we're going to get to later on in the show, specifically aftercare and some of the breakdown after kids leave these programs, because the change is remarkable, as you said. Transformative is a good word for it. And then how is that built upon? And you know, the slippage is the part that's been frustrating for me as a clinician. So we'll get into that. Thank you for the call, Kevin.
Yeah, you're welcome. We've seen our students, eighth graders, going in the ninth. Our graduation rate for Alaska Native student eighth graders that we've provided programs to go up to 89%, which is this work is very important. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Kevin. All right. So let's get into a little bit of the background and philosophy at Alaska Crossings. I know back in the, you know, late 70s, 80s, there was this whole survival school component that swept the country, and there was a lot of bad press about wilderness programs and, you know, really being difficult on kids' survival skill more, schools more so. But that's not what Alaska Crossings is doing. Can you give us a little bit of the philosophy and the background of Crossings?
We are very much different than those programs. We really take a very positive approach with the youth that we work with. Don't see that the negative sort of boot camp approach is appropriate for a behavioral health environment. So basically, we are focused on a lot of positive things, and I'll just talk a little bit about some of our core values. We're a reward-based program, and we believe in building children up, not breaking them down. We attempt to realign a child's sense of self to a more positive and productive framework. Again, thinking in positive terms. We believe in a consistent and mentoring relationship with our staff, and that is a key to promoting positive change. We believe in joy and optimism, and we believe that those are learned behaviors. You know, a lot of the programs that you're referring to worked on sort of a deprivation model where kids would only really learn or earn the basic things that they needed through modifying their behavior. We don't believe that. We believe that youth's basic needs must be met before emotional growth can take place, and that change should not come through a desire to cease physical discomfort, but it must be based in intention. So we believe that the wilderness is something that should be enjoyed and to be lived in, not just survived. One of the things that we never do is use food in an attempt to modify behavior. Again, we believe that the youth should be comfortable, they should be enjoying themselves. And so we really come at it from a perspective of reinforcing strength instead of focusing on weaknesses.
All right. Can somebody talk about experiential education as the model? Is that sort of the model you guys use? And just speak to how you access that and use that at Crossings.
Experiential education, really, if we look at it as a model for change or just sort of a vessel, then yes, that is something that we incorporate. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Casey speaking.
Oh, thank you.
I'll get better about it. That is something that we incorporate in our model. So essentially what we're doing with wilderness therapy is we're trying to provide a positive experience for our youth to develop, and essentially we're trying to promote social and emotional learning. We do differ from experiential education in several points, primarily because we do have licensed mental health professionals who work with our youth. We identify treatment goals that our youth are focusing on, which are individualized. And we also provide, you know, individual group and family therapy with professionals. So that's pretty different from the educational component in that sense. We are really using the wilderness therapy as a vessel for our behavioral health. And so what's really exciting about that is that we get this opportunity in the setting that we operate in to teach our clients, you know, new ways of being in their environment. We teach them a whole lot of skills where they get that immediate feedback loop of yeah, I'm doing better at this than I was yesterday, and I'm a lot better than I was 2 weeks ago, whether that be setting up their TARP or dealing with conflict with their peers. And so it's really pretty all-encompassing, and it really incorporates that experiential education model as sort of a vessel that we're using to provide behavioral health services.
Okay, Wilderness is the platform at which you, like, access change. I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing you saying. How is the Wilderness specifically? I mean, how does the Wilds, how does that promote change versus doing this at, you know, at a hospital setting out on the playground with ropes course? I mean, what's different?
Well, this is Steve. I'll give a try on that one. I think there's differing opinions between people about the value that Wilderness has in this therapeutic process. I think it's pretty clear that there is an inherently therapeutic aspect to being in the wilderness. We heard you talk about that a little bit. I think that's true for our participants as well. There's no doubt the experiential aspect to the wilderness tripping model that we use. I think the way that it ties in for us is that, for example, if we have a canoe expedition that we're going to embark upon, it's a purposeful expedition with a goal. It takes a lot of work and a lot of coordinated social activity in order to successfully complete an expedition like that. And so not only is it then the physical act of canoeing, but it's also providing the opportunity to be involved in a challenging social activity that requires a high degree of functionality in order to successfully complete. And that's what provides the opportunity for us to teach skills and intervene, and in terms of the therapeutic experiential aspect, it provides an opportunity for the participants to not only learn skills but to practice them and to be coached in a supportive atmosphere on how to utilize those skills.
This is Casey again. I just want to tag on to that as well, Steve. I feel that one of the other major components is that it is somewhat of a controlled environment. And so we are essentially, I mean, with the exception of our inability to control the weather or, you know, animals in the environment, our youth do not have access to distracting stimuli such as, you know, social media, substances, electronics, negative peer groups. Essentially, they are out there with access to the resources that we provide them with the people that we've sent them with. So there's, in that sense, it's a bit liberating, I feel, for a lot of our youth because they have no ties or connections or responsibilities to anyone other than each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for many of them, it sounds like it's probably the first time they've been unplugged for more than a few hours since they plugged in.
Yeah, and it's actually really funny to watch that adaptation. You know, we've had kids that make jokes about, oh, I'm going to go plug in my iTarp because they have no access to any of those things anymore. And for some of them, it's very challenging, and for others, it's very liberating.
Okay, I want to, for those who might be tuning in late, want to remind listeners that my guests today are Steve Helgeson, Kelly Jo Pruitt, Casey Odell, and Katie Fitzgerald from the Alaska Crossings Program in Wrangell, Alaska. Our topic today is experiential education and wilderness-based treatment for teens with behavioral and emotional problems. We want to remind listeners you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. Our local number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell that out. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Please do call in if you have an experience to share about Alaska Crossings or any other wilderness-based type treatment program, or if you have a personal story about how the wilderness affects you and your mental health. All right, back to some of the conversation at hand. Casey, yes, you mentioned a second ago something that I wanted to touch on. I'd be concerned about safety. You guys are taking these kids out into the wilderness. You mentioned inclement weather. You mentioned animals. Safety is these are 12-year-olds, my understanding, 12 to 18 is the age group. How do you guys make sure these kids are coming back, and how's your safety record?
This is Steve. I think I'll try to field this one. Well, we've been operating, I think this is our 14th year. We have had an incident or two. We did have one incident so far with a bear so far in our history that turned out well. There was nothing serious that came of it. But by and large, I think our safety record is pretty good. But let's talk about the risks that we have, because there certainly are inherent risks in outdoor activities, just like there are risks in many of the other things we do every day, like driving, for example, or high school football. We can't eliminate risk from any activities that we're doing any more than we could eliminate risk from those activities. But what we do is we try to manage those risks or mitigate those risks so that the benefit that we can derive from those activities outweighs the remaining potential risks. So basically the theory then is to, and for example, in the case of driving, we might mitigate those risks through training, driver's training, through the application of driving rules and laws, stop signs, traffic lights, but also the use of safety equipment and seat belts. So the theory of managing risks for us is really going to be fairly similar. We're going to try to identify the risks that we face out there. We will develop and employ practices that are designed to address and reduce those risks. We'll train both the guides and the participants in the use of our accepted practices. And then we monitor and analyze incidents that do occur so that we can improve our practices and through the lessons that we've learned. So I thought maybe what I'd do is talk a little bit about one of the activities that we do a lot of, canoeing, and just explain how risk management might work, or does work, I should say, for us in the case of canoeing. So if we look at the major risks that are associated with canoeing, basically they have to do with capsizing. It would be drowning. If you're going to be around the water in any kind of a boat, you can certainly drown. And there's also cold water immersion, which, of course, hypothermia is another significant risk. So we can't eliminate that. Those risks are inherent in canoeing, and if we were to try to remove those risks entirely, we'd be basically left with putting a canoe on our living room floor and paddling in the living room. So
you might get to a pool. You could do a pool maybe, but
a pool maybe. But even in a pool, you know, there's the risk of drowning. So basically, we identify the risk, and then we employ a variety of strategies to try to reduce or mitigate those risks. So the first thing we do, of course, is training. It's the most important thing we do. In the case of canoeing, the best way to keep from drowning or getting hypothermia is to not capsize. So we train both the participants and the guide staff in the proper use of canoes and the stability of canoes, various paddling strokes, and importantly, how to rescue a boat that in fact does capsize. We employ a variety of different pieces of safety equipment, like PFDs or life jackets, spray decks, which are used to keep waves and spray out of the canoes. We have cargo loops, which are used to tie down the cargo inside of a boat so that your equipment and food can't shift and cause an instability problem. We use wetsuits when they're appropriate, and helmets in moving water. So those are some of the examples of safety equipment that we might use. And then the accepted practices that we have work together with safety equipment to really provide a deeper safety net. So, for example, with PFDs, they're worn all the time around the water. We just don't take any chances. Anytime we're in a boat or near the water on a dock, PFDs are worn. We do things like stay relatively close to the shore in canoes, except when we're making intentional crossings from landmass to landmass, so that it's easy to get ashore if we capsize.
Yeah, because we're talking about ocean open. I mean, kayaking, right? Open ocean, like.
Well, yeah. So our environment. First of all, we use canoes, not kayaks.
Right.
So we have, and they're two-person canoes, and it is the open ocean. But the open ocean in inner southeast Alaska, around Wrangell, is essentially like a large saltwater lake. There's not an active surf.
Okay.
It's an archipelago of islands, and we basically hop from island to island. It's not to say that it can't get rough here. It can, but quite often it's like a mill pond, and so it's a little different than paddling in the open ocean. It's basically protected ocean, protected waters, but still there's significant risk from wind and tide and weather. We addressed those issues with our practices. For example, if we're going to make an ocean crossing, in other words, cross from one island to another, we'll do things like find the shortest possible route to make that crossing, so our exposure is limited. We always listen to the weather report and take a look at the tide and current before we make the decision to make a crossing. We would monitor, for example, the status of a group, both physically and emotionally, to see that everyone is feeling healthy before we attempt to make a crossing. So we're very methodical. So essentially, we mitigate the risks through training, through the use of equipment, and through good practices. And then, as I said, if we do have an incident, for example, if we a canoe that capsizes, we would look very closely at that incident and analyze it. And if we need to update or change any of our practices in response to that, we would do that right away.
So safety is paramount. These are kids we're dealing with, people's children, and it sounds like the number one thing you guys are focused on is safety and bringing these guys home safe.
There's no doubt about it. You know, I'm a parent.
Yeah.
And I tell my crew all the time, we need to act as though these are our own children and make decisions based upon that assumption. It's our duty of care.
Great. So take us through briefly, whoever wants to tackle this can, like an actual expedition. How long is a crossings expedition and how is it sort of broken down? Just take us through the sequence of events from, say, like, kid comes in and you're off. What's the process?
This is Casey, and I'll be happy to go over that with you. So essentially what happens is we if we're getting it from the point of when they get here, our team goes and picks them up from the airport. All of our participants fly in because we live on an island. There's no really other way to get here. Oh, actually, we had a kid come in on the ferry once, didn't we? We did. I'm sorry. Anyway, what we do is as soon as they get to our community, we take them over to our clinic where they get checked out by our medical director just to make sure that everything is A-okay before we send them out. We do things at that time. They meet with the case manager and they call home and say, hey, we made it. We're okay. And we change them from their personal clothing into our equipment. So we offer, appropriate and tested gear that we know is going to be helpful for them to keep them comfortable in our environment. And we have them meet with their clinician, and then during the summer months when we have enough daylight, we round them all up and we take them out to our floating facility via jet boat. And so within that, of course, there are various steps. They have, they go through PFD training, so essentially their head guide and their field guides talk with them about the safety equipment that they're going to be using every step of the way, which starts with the personal flotation device. They then all go down to the float house where they do what we call the 72-hour plan, which is essentially their first introduction to the skills they're going to need on their first expedition. So during that time, they watch a bear safety video. They learn paddle strokes. They do the float test, which is when we have them jump in the water so that we know how they'll respond when they are in a cold water environment, and it's in a controlled area. They do other things like learning their camp skills, how to set up their tarp, how to pack their bag, how to load a canoe, and all of those skills are taught to them within the safety and comfort of our floating facility for those first 2 to 3 days. After that, they start on their first expedition, which is usually a canoeing expedition. They usually paddle away from the float house and go on a predetermined route for their first expedition, which usually is based upon, you know, their skill level and which areas we have available to them at that time.
All right. Excuse me just a second. I hate to interrupt, but I got to take a little mid-break. We'll come back in just a second, and we'll pick up from leaving the float house. So I want to remind folks you're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. Our topic today is wilderness-based treatment for teens with behavioral and emotional problems. If you want to participate, our local number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion with our panel from Alaska Crossings. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Steve Helgeson, Casey O'Dell, Kelly Jo Pruitt, and Katie Fitzgerald from Alaska Crossings Program in Wrangell, Alaska. Our topic today is wilderness-based treatment for teens with emotional and behavioral problems. A quick reminder that Dr. Woodard will continue to host Line One 3 Mondays each month, and I will host a show once a month that's focused on emotional and mental health. Also want to remind listeners that you can podcast today's show and access the library of archive shows by visiting our website at alaskapublic.org and clicking on the link to Line One. Remember, you can email questions or comments about today's topic to line1@alaskapublic.org, call locally at 550-8433. Or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, you will be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. Okay, before the break, we were discussing the Crossings program, and you're heading out on an expedition. So, Kelly Jo, I guess, like, you're a field guide, and you're the one who's, like, out there day-to-day with the kids. What kind of, on a typical day, what's happening with the kids, and what are you teaching them? What are you doing?
So Casey was saying there's different types of expeditions. We have a canoeing expedition, a hiking expedition. So I'll touch on the canoeing because that's one of the prime components of our program. So in the mornings, once established, kind of figuring out how to set up their tarps and the basics. In the mornings, we are on the move almost daily, changing campsites and continuing along on our expedition. So mornings, generally, the youth wake up, they pack all their belongings, their gear that we've given them primarily, and they take down their tarp, they load the canoes, they then eat breakfast. We all eat breakfast together, and then we head out. And on a given day, depending on weather and the route, we'll generally paddle 5 to 15 miles. And then We always stop for a lunch break somewhere along the way. Generally, we do a journal exercise with the youth, and then we continue on through the day. And, you know, throughout paddling, we're doing games with them, getting to know them, interacting with them, teaching them along the way different aspects of Southeast Alaska and the landscape, the wilderness, the water. And then in the afternoons, we generally pull up to camp and we'll unload canoes, we'll set up camp and get dinner going. And sometimes they have free time or not really free time, but time to just maybe do some more group games, interactions, maybe to explore a little bit along with the guides. And then after dinner, generally we have group, followed by one of my favorite times of the day is points. So we really emphasize building the kids up, and so giving them back feedback, both positive and constructive, of what they've done well throughout the day and what they could work on tomorrow to assist them in their treatment goals. And then generally it's bedtime and we'll get ready, and self-care is really important, especially being in the wilderness. And so personal their safety, both physically and emotionally, is one of our prime concerns and so priorities. And so at night we will read them a story, and during story time, and one of the guides goes through and meets each kid at their tarp sites and checks in with them, and also checks for cold weather injuries and making sure that they are still healthy and fit. And then it's time to go to bed.
And you're reading a story like Go Dog Go, or are you like this is having a little bit more like
yeah.
Story time.
Story time's my favorite time. Most of these kids maybe haven't ever been read stories at home. And so generally the guides will switch off reading, and they'll stand in a central location in between all the tarps. And the books generally are targeted to be in a way that would encourage the youth and maybe meet them at places where they're at. And so learning through or listening through stories definitely aids in their treatment, and it's also provides comfort out in the wilderness too. And youth love it. The kids would just get really excited and get all tucked in, and it was a time of the day that I was surprised to see even high school guys really enjoying just kind of relaxing and listening to a story as they snooze off.
And that's sort of a new experience, like you said, for a lot of these kids. I mean, do you notice this is a question just popped in my head. How are these kids doing with the adjustment from all this connectivity and texting and immediacy of information? How are they doing slowing down? Is it difficult at first and then they adjust over time?
I think that's really dependent on the youth. There's definitely a challenge I saw at the beginning of a program where they are disconnected and they're bored almost, or they're so used to just...
I hear that all the time. Yeah. I'm bored.
I know. And I don't understand in the wilderness how you could be bored, but it's
there's nothing to do.
There's new... But then they learn. And we had two kids on our program who they rapped every morning, and they just livened up the camp. And they learn to interact in new ways and kind of create their own... plug in, I guess, with each other. And so that was really neat to see them starting to interact on different wavelengths.
It sort of forces them to come out of their shell and to engage in like what we call the old ways of like cooperation and eye contact and talking and body language.
Yeah. You see a lot of that. And kids, you know, especially being out in the wilderness, you see them connect with nature, and a lot of them might not have ever had that opportunity either. And so some of the youth would be fascinated by the crabs and the starfish, and teaching them how to engage with the wilderness in a way that's not harmful either is something that is an important part.
You're teaching stewardship,
exactly,
responsibility to our world and our environment. All right, so yeah, go ahead.
I, I'm, Sorry, this is Casey again. I just wanted to kind of add one sort of component that overlays our expeditionary model. So like we had mentioned previously, it's broken up into three different expeditions. So one of them, like Kelly Jo just described, is a paddling expedition followed by a hiking expedition and then another paddling expedition. And along with that, we have a three-phase model for the progression of the treatment, essentially. And so the first phase during that first expedition is really forming the foundations of the program. So, you know, you're building rapport and learning the culture, and they're learning how to be safe, keep themselves safe, keep each other safe. So that's really the focus of the first phase. And at the conclusion of that, so after the first expedition, they get an impact letter from home, which is really, really important to help propel them into the next phase.
What's the purpose of the impact letter? What does that mean?
So the impact letter is something that we work with our families on. So our families, you know, aren't entirely off the hook.
Right.
They also have their own end of the bargain that they need to hold up with these young fellas or ladies. And the impact letter is really the idea, you know, all of our youth are coming to this program because they're struggling in one area of their life, whether it be at home, at school, in the community, or all of those places, or several of those places. And so, as you know, in any family unit, when someone is struggling, it affects everyone. And so the idea of the impact letter is to really talk about that, address how, you know, whatever it is that's happening in the family, how that has been an impact, and what they would like for the future, for when the youth returns home. So essentially talking about what has happened and what their hopes for the future are. And that comes at a point where most of our youth are feeling, you know, homesick and really, really kind of wondering, what am I doing here? And it really helps them to refocus on the purpose of the program. So, and essentially refocusing on their treatment goals. So that's a pretty exciting thing, and it helps. We usually have our directing clinician, so either myself or Jerry D, go out during that transition. And then the next phase of the program, which is typically the hike, there's a lot more emphasis and focus on their individual treatment goals and really working to get to the meat of what's going on for them. And then that's followed by a transition group reflection time, which is it's a very special time for our programs, where it's an intentional sort of 48-hour period where our youth are given their own spot in the woods, and they're asked not to interact with each other except for during very specific times like meals. And so it's sort of this very intentional time for them to be alone and reflect. And they're given journal assignments and they're given various things, but the parents have also worked with their treatment team to develop a homecoming plan. And that's usually looking like what's they can expect for when they return home. So we've been working on developing rules and expectations and setting up activities for them that they might be interested in, whether it be basketball or cheerleading or volunteering at the animal shelter, depending on their community and what's available to them. So the families generate this homecoming plan and give it to the participant, and the participant has then this time to reflect and start being very intentional on what they want. And they also write a homecoming plan back to their families to say, this is what I would like for when I come home, and this is how I feel about the rules and guidelines and expectations that have been developed. And it's a pretty intentional time, at the end of which the group comes back together and they do their final expedition.
All right, that sounds like a solo sort of or vision quest kind of thing. That's pretty common in a lot of wilderness-based programs. That's good stuff. I guess the next question I have is, what types of kids, like if you're a parent, and like we're running out of time fast, so I want to jump ahead to this, but if you're a parent, what kind of behaviors, who would be appropriate for Alaska Crossings or for a wilderness-based program? Like what kind of behaviors are we looking at?
So essentially, the clients that we're looking at are youth who are struggling significantly in one or more areas of their life, sort of like I was just talking about. We see folks with a pretty broad spectrum of problems. So we, you know, a lot of oppositional defiant disorder, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, depression, various anxieties. We see a lot of folks with post-traumatic stress symptoms.
Right.
A lot of our youth are struggling with poor self-esteem and just kind of struggling in those ways. It's really important to make sure, so that's why we have a pretty extensive intake process. We want to make sure that our program is going to be the best fit for them. So within that, you know, we see a lot of comorbidity with substances. However, we're not a substance abuse specific program. So those are just kind of some of those things. And we're also very limited by, I wouldn't say we're very limited. We're limited in that we need participants who can make sure that they can keep themselves and the other participants safe in this environment, if that makes sense.
So the things that would eliminate somebody from being a good candidate for a wilderness-based program like Alaska Crossings would be suicidal risk, aggression, severe psychotic disorders, things like that?
Yes, exactly. So if it's a severe suicidal ideation, if they're very aggressive or if they're sexually aggressive, that's really something that we cannot manage in this setting, and we want to make sure that folks that are struggling to that degree are really receiving a higher level of care that's really going to be able to address their symptomology.
Okay, so if I'm a parent and I've sent my kid to Alaska Crossings or to the Wilderness Treatment Center in Idaho place, and my kids are coming back from that place, what should I do as a parent to get myself ready? Because I have the problem that I have seen so much with Alaska Crossings is, despite, or any of these other programs, despite the changes, they come back to the same environment. And this is what we started the show with from Homer. What can parents do to prepare themselves to change so that they can support and nurture the changes that their kids have made? That's the problem that I find.
So from my clinical perspective, one of the things that we often recommend for parents whose children are going through this experience is we do recommend that they themselves engage in family therapy, like independently and in their community. We do offer some of that with our program, but I feel that it's always good to seek out those other supportive services, parenting classes, any kind of groups that they might have access to. We are often very much encouraging of that. We also do discuss a lot about taking a pretty keen and critical eye to, you know, the rules and expectations and the follow-through of those rules and expectations that were happening before the youth left the home and how those things might be clarified and improved prior to them coming back. Other things that we really want to look for is helping the families to really establish their own support network so that if once the youth comes home, they're continuing to feel that they have the support that they need to make sure that they are effectively parenting their youth and being fully capable of managing whatever behaviors might be cropping up. We also highly, highly recommend, you know, follow-up outpatient services for all of the youth that come out of our program. Again, understanding some of the limitations depending on where the youth is coming from. And then other things is really stepping up their game of finding positive and productive activities for their youth to be engaged in once they come home. So we're very strong advocates of, you know, after-school activities, setting up those mentorships, or, you know, sometimes with our Native youth, we want them to get connected with their community elders and various things to make sure that they have positive outlets for their energy.
Yeah, there does seem to be a fall off. I had a kid that came back from Crossings, and he was raring to go. He wanted to hike Crow Pass, and he wanted to do Resurrection Trail, and his parents just said, well, we don't have any of that stuff, and his parents couldn't do anything, and they couldn't drive him there. They didn't have enough money, and the kid just, like, drifted back into playing video games and hooking up on his headset, and it was really discouraging.
It is a significant challenge for us because of the fact that we're located in Wrangell, but the youth that we serve are from all over Alaska.
Right.
And if they were primarily kids from our community, then we could more directly support that aftercare. But we really have to rely upon services that are available in their communities and places where there are no services on parents, mentors, and elders.
So it's super important that you guys coordinate and collaborate with community organizations and families and really have a support plan in place if you want to. I'm sure the difference in recidivism rates is astronomical with parents that are involved and participate actively throughout the process.
It is quite a difference. Our youth really do want their families to also be engaged and make positive changes. That's one of the primary concerns we deal with during that group reflection time, is we hear that a lot, you know, well, I'm doing all this work, but I'm afraid they're not doing anything. And so, for parents that are sending kids to our programs, we really want to encourage them to just take the opportunity to really work on deciding what they want for themselves and their family for when their youth comes home. Because really, and one of the things that we often tell our youth is, you know, program is really hard, but in the grand scheme of things, this is just the beginning. This is the easy part. What's going to be really challenging is going home and taking all of these skills and putting them into action.
All right, we have I got an email here I want to get to real quick. It's two questions. Have you all seen an uptick in serious psychological events for this target client group since the introduction of SPICE in 2009? Second question, where can one find help for a 20-year-old who may be physically 20, but because of severe long-term depression is more like 17? So those are the two questions. You guys have some kids, like if you have any experience with SPICE and Kelly Jo maybe down at Covenant House, have you seen stuff happening?
Yeah, SPICE I think is one of the most destructive things I've seen happen to our youth, and I've watched kids descend into psychosis and not come out of it.
Yeah.
It's very destructive, and I've noticed it a lot more so the fall 2013, in that winter, mm-hmm. last winter. And I know that APD's gotten a little stricter with making it illegal and kind of nipping it in the bud. But so I've seen less lately, but it's so destructive.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. I would agree with that. I've seen some kids end up in API from one time smoking it and
mm-hmm.
And didn't come back all the way for like weeks. Hallucinating.
I've seen kids never come back from it. Yeah.
Okay. Where can one find help for a 20-year-old and maybe physically 20, but severe long-term depression, 17? I'll take that one. I think from a clinical perspective, I see a lot of kids who are in their early 20s and sort of stuck in mid to late adolescence because of substance abuse and depression and anxiety. And they're too busy being angry and upset and hurt to really focus on the maturation process and achieving things in school. So I would start with somebody, like getting him involved with somebody to talk one-on-one and figure out what he wants to do and what his plan is. I mean, he's a 20-year-old young man. So if you could maybe send us an email, and I'll get in touch with you after the show, and we'll brainstorm about that, and I'll give you some ideas anyway. Okay, so cost. Real quickly, I don't even like to talk about this, but it's a reality. Cost, is this covered by insurance? Is there a payment plan? Are there scholarships? Help me out here if a parent wants to send their kid, but they are afraid of the resources.
This is Katie. The cost of the Alaska Crossings program is covered in full by Alaska Medicaid, with the exception of travel to and from the program, so we ask that families contribute to that when they can. Medicaid is and has been the primary payment source for families for our program. We do bill private insurance, but unfortunately,
Most private insurances pay very little to nothing for the cost of our services. Recently, in the past couple months, we've been looking more into options for families that are interested in private pay, though the cost would be somewhere around $26,000 for the cost of the 48-day program. So at this point, we are primarily serving families with Medicaid coverage.
And that's, that's a chunk of money, but that's consistent with what I've found in researching across the country. Some of these wilderness programs are around that, which is considerably less expensive, I believe, than some of the hospital stays, which insurances do cover. So can somebody, educate us as to what the difference is?
Well, the cost of our services, to my understanding, largely aren't covered by private insurance because the bulk of our services are provided by behavioral health associates rather than directly by a licensed clinician. Though the licensed clinicians are guiding our staff and overseeing what they do, but that poses a problem for a lot of insurance companies. In addition, other insurance agencies aren't on board with the wilderness setting of it and won't pay for services for that reason.
All right. Well, I think that's a shame, and maybe that's something that we should all talk to some folks about, because I think what you guys do and what other wilderness programs do in our country and around the world is pretty remarkable, and I wish there was more of it. And I think kids benefit from it greatly. So any parting shots? We're running out of time. Any of you guys down in Wrangell have any final words? We got 2 minutes left, so real quickly.
Well, this is Steve. I just want to thank you for having us today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And just want to say that we are devoted to our mission, which is helping youth succeed. And we believe that wilderness therapy is very effective in doing that. So thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Steve. Anyone else?
This is Casey Prentice. I just want to kind of echo that. And I wanted to say thank you to Kelly Jo for taking time to go down to this station and be a part of this.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm so grateful, too. I'm a big supporter and fan of Crossings.
All right. My thanks to today's guests, Steve Helgeson, Casey O'Dell, Kelly Jo Pruitt, and Katie Fitzgerald from Alaska Crossings, for taking the time to join me for today's show. If you'd like to continue today's conversation, join KSK on Facebook. You can find the link on our website. It's alaskapublic.org. And you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. If your son or daughter is struggling with emotional or behavioral problems and you have exhausted traditional community-based options for intervention, it might be time to consider some type of out-of-home placement. Hospitalization might be the best option if your child is suicidal or is experiencing an acute psychiatric emergency. If, on the other hand, you are not ready to go the hospital route and are considering a more experiential education approach, the right wilderness treatment program is worth considering. This action is one that no parent wants to take, and one that will have a profound impact on your child and family. Whatever course you pursue, be sure to educate yourself about all the options and research whatever programs you're considering for safety history and treatment philosophy to make sure that it's a good fit for your child's needs. On the next Line One, Dr. Woodard will discuss what is being done to support the health and wellness of the 23% of Alaskans who live with a disability. Joining him to discuss the state of Alaska's health and disability program will be Joanne Sullivan, RN, Michelle Geralt, and Amanda Cooper. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, November 3rd at 2 o'clock, repeating that same evening at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1 KSK Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Please remember, if a fish is judged on its ability to fly, it will spend the entirety of its life feeling inadequate. Unless, of course, it's a flying fish. Thanks for listening. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.